Hi, everybody. And those of you I can't see, but you can see me, which is odd, of course. So sometime in 1995 or 96, I was sitting right back there in the right corner of the room on the third day of a week-long retreat. Norman, as a lot of you know, is the founder of Everyday Zen. He was the abbot here then. And he was giving the traditional talk that always happens on the third day of a retreat. He was talking about how to work with the pain people were feeling in their knees and hips and backs and necks, reminding us again and again that death was coming. It was the great matter. We didn't know when it was coming, even though we had fantasies about it. We were not going to escape it. Saying all that in his usual clear and poetic voice. The next day, during his talk, he started up by saying, "Maybe I overdid it yesterday with all that talk about death." Then he went on to read this extraordinary poem on death without exaggeration by the Nobel laureate poet Szymborska. The title gives you the gist of the poem. Death is important, and it's not omnipotent, and it's not everything. This turned everything for me on its head. It gave me the chance to see that I had come to a conclusion that I thought was true, and that I was now fully believing and holding on so tight that I was stuck, and I didn't know it until that moment. This was my first personal encounter with the real spirit of Zen, and led me to being here today, totally unpredictable that I would get to do this with you and you, but here it is. So here's the official beginning of my talk. Thank you for being here today. They always say that, but you know, when we're sitting in this chair, or you're sitting in your chair, we are really grateful that you're here. Whether you're in this room, or if you are in the Zoom room, it is quite something to interrupt our usual lives of busy activities and come here to this beautiful setting and into a room saturated with decades of practice, and simply stop moving. Stop accomplishing, and feel what it's like to be ourselves right now, in the middle of our life, in this moment. Whether you're here in this room or somewhere in your home or wherever you are on through the Zoom connection, you're also interrupting your life. The life that we are always in the middle of. By the time we became aware that we had a life, say at age 7 or so, we were already in the middle of it. What are you in the middle of right now? Have you ever tried to not be in the middle of your life? Often we try to pull away from our lives. Yet, even on a far away, tranquil South Sea island, we cannot get away from it all. After some brief respite, enjoying the lapping waves and tropical breezes, our usual familiar ways of thinking and feeling, behaving and reacting return in full force. You may have noticed that yourself today. After a while of being in a new place, which catalyzed some new experiences, the habitual thoughts, worries, planning, anticipation, emotions, and moods returned. They reappeared. That's because our body-mind reliably generates our perceived personal reality wherever we are. You may have noticed that today. I'm not speaking metaphorically. Modern science, which has the ability to notice brain activity in real time, tells us that the raw sensory data, for example, light, enters our retina, then our brain, and is immediately compared to other examples of historic light that have come in to our body. And the brain only passes it along to other parts of the brain after it's received if that pattern is familiar, if it's been recognized as important. If it's not recognized as important, it gets ignored. This means we keep noticing the same things over and over, and even begin to look for them in new situations. We call things that draw our attention relevant. In this way, our personal reality keeps being generated by our nervous system over and again. That has our life feel continuous and familiar. One of the other ways we are always in the middle of our life is because, in a very real way, it did not start when we were born. In every case, we were born into pre-existing circumstances. These circumstances include a time and place, being embedded with people speaking a particular language, who engage in certain cultural practices, and who have dealt with traumatic events. These language and practices are immediately transmitted through touch, hearing, and smell, and a nascent sense of sight. These experiences build the architecture of our nervous system and consequently determine what can be perceived and considered relevant later. We act on what we take to be relevant, what our nervous system, usually below our level of awareness, sorted out as relevant. And when we behave from there, we strengthen the pre-existing brain architecture, giving us the experience of recurrence, of always being in the middle. Buddhism calls this whole process karma. What we have personally lived through, and also what has been passed to us through our family and culture by way of language and practice. What is considered relevant underlies all our plans, sense of identity, quality of relationship, assessments of success and failure, and even what you are making of our time together today at Green Gulch. We can call our perceptual cognitive filter of relevance. That's just a fancy way of saying relevance again. We can call our relevance filter our orientation. It comes to us in the South Sea Islands, our jobs, our families, our relationships, to our spiritual practice. We cannot escape orientation. In many ways, it's what being a person means. It comes to exist as we live and disappears when we die. No one else has the same one. It's how we know ourselves and others. All knowledge originates here. The point of our orientation is to make sure we find a way to take what we have lived, learned, into the current situation so we can cope, survive, and perhaps even thrive. That's yet another way of talking about why we always feel like we are in the middle of our life. It's our physical and social survival strategy, one we took up unexamined because we were too young to examine it from our familial upbringing, who in turn absorbed it from their family environment, back and back and back our orientation goes. It's made slightly unique by our individual experience and our contemporary cultural surround. As I've said, it precedes and curates current experience while always staying invisible itself. Orientation is a lot like eyeglasses. We can make sense of what we see because of them. We look through them, not at them. Perhaps orientation is even more like contact lenses, which we can't see while they are in use. Here's the Zen part if you were wondering if I was ever going to get to it. That was the Zen part too, but I'll say Zen words now. Orientation. Dogen, let's see where I am here. Yes, here I am. Orientation, our relevance landscape, is the fundamental foundation of Dogen's teachings. For those of you who don't know, Dogen lived from 1200 to 1253 in Japan. He was raised in a monastery from an early age because both of his parents had died. Dissatisfied with the Zen teaching he found around him in Japan, he took a perilous sea journey to China, seeking authentic teaching. He found it, and then returned to teach for several decades, founding a monastery that still exists. He inspired many thousands of students, including Sunru Suzuki, who came to the U.S. in 1959 and went on to found San Francisco Zen Center. Everyday Zen is a stream from this river. Dogen wrote thousands of pages in many formats, essays called fascicles, talks, instruction manuals, poems, commentaries on koans. One of his earliest essays is called Bendoa in English, The Wholehearted Way. There are different translations of it. Of course, in English, that's my favorite one, The Wholehearted Way. I think us humans have been looking for a wholehearted way for a long time. What can I pour everything into and not hold anything back? Sometimes we hope it's that really cute person that we found. We try that out. Lots of us pour it out into our children, but then they grow up. So Dogen wrote something for us called The Wholehearted Way. It's what we're studying in Everyday Zen this month. You may have heard the wonderful talk that our friend Alan did on Wednesday, and we're going to continue studying it for a while. So where my talk came from today. In all of his teachings, Dogen keeps inviting us to realize we have an automatic inherited orientation, which we identify as reality. We preconsciously sort out what is relevant or not, the process I've been calling orientation. It can have us continue to take clumsy actions that cause suffering for ourselves, messes for others, and huge problems for the entire global ecosystem. Many of us try correcting from these mistakes by shifting our actions. But until we uncover and dislodge our hidden orientation, the actions flowing from there will always be out of tune with the moment. Please remember, our orientation lives in the very architecture of our perceptual system, how our nervous system is laid out. It selects and arranges sensory inputs according to what has historically kept us physically and socially viable. It is always out of date, not of this moment and place. And yet it is totally convincing. We get stuck in it, and we usually are. Here's an example from my own life. In about the year 2000, I was invited by a graduate of our coaching school to help launch our program in Canada. I flew to Ottawa. Americans might know, but Ottawa is the capital of Canada. And I spoke with many government officials, gave a talk to a group they had gathered together, and then went ahead and put together a year-long program through both her efforts and mine. We had begun a successful business collaboration, which felt to me mutually satisfying. But shortly after that, she cut off all contact. A year later, I found out that she had taken what I understood to be materials from my class and started her own program. She also copyrighted the name of my work in Canada so that I could not use it ever again in that country. Here's the surprise part. I got really upset. My business partners and friends echoed and strengthened my righteous indignation. When I went to talk to Norman about it, I anticipated that he would join in the correctness of my view and use some Zen balm to soothe me. Yes, you can tell what's coming. Instead, he said, "That's what always happens." That's what students always do. They take up the work and use it themselves. I was stunned. And my orientation fell away in the recognition that I had taken one up and that it was distorting my full encounter with reality. We all have our own examples of this. Probably all of us here today, now, or often, feel something is off. We may feel anxious, depressed, lonely, vaguely dissatisfied, at a distance from ourselves, others, and life, floating around looking for purpose and meaning, discouraged because our life doesn't seem to add up to much, or we feel thwarted in our intention to support others, express artistically, improve the world. We are bumping up against our orientation. Dogen saw and felt the same suffering and noted the inadequacy of response he saw in the Zen around him in Japan. He noticed folks chanting in often mindless, mechanical ways, reading texts with the ardent hope they had the answer about what to do, how to live, or he saw them blindly following, imitating others. None of that was shifting orientation. Instead, those activities were reinforcing pre-existing realities. Something more radical, more to the root, was called for. What could that be? He knew everything he said would be perceived so as to fit and reinforce the current orientation of his listeners. He realized each person has to encounter their own world making directly, and then and thereby be liberated from it. What could do something at the very deep level of our nervous perceptual system, not reading or studying, not listening to talks or doing ceremonies? He saw that we have everything we need, but we were employing it in the wrong way. Our innate wisdom, Bodhi, had been imprisoned in our body-mind in the service of our daily coping, our orientation. Here's one way he says all that in the Bendawa. You should also know that we unquestionably lack nothing of unsurpassed Bodhi. But although we receive and use it endlessly, we cannot fully accept it. We mindlessly make our rising views habitual and think even of this teaching as an object, thus vainly stumbling on the great way. One of his recurring, relentless methods is to denigrate activities and beliefs that keep us welded to our orientation. He was not merely being judgmental. Rather, he was shaking someone who is deeply asleep and who keeps taking sleeping potions. Furthermore, do you really know the virtue to be gained by working at such practices as reading sutras or chanting Nambutu? The notion that merely making sounds by moving your tongue will lead to the virtue of the Buddha way is completely meaningless. I think that's how he probably said it. Is extremely far, tremendously distant from resembling Buddha Dharma. Vainly wasting your thinking and discrimination does not compare to the virtue of gaining wisdom. Intending to reach the Buddha way through ceaseless chanting millions of times is like steering a cart north and trying to go south. It is also the same as trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Reading literature while ignoring the way of practice is like a person reading a prescription but forgetting to take the medicine. What is the benefit of continuously uttering sounds like frogs in a spring rice paddy, croaking day and night? It is also ultimately worthless. Furthermore, people deeply blinded by fame and profit have difficulty abandoning those things because their greed is exceedingly deep. Since this was the case in ancient times, why would it be different in modern times? Maybe you've noticed some greed around here. I think I've seen some. We must feel the utmost sympathy. Dogen is determined, unstoppable, endlessly creative and generative in finding ways to entice us, invite us into the proven way of freeing us from our orientation. Zazen. A practice with the central virtue of being completely useless. It does not strengthen our distorted version of ourselves or propose actions to help us succeed. Those would only strengthen our troublemaking orientation. Rather, in Zazen, we are given an extraordinary chance to suspend all of our concerns and activities and directly encounter life as it arises. This may include, and often does, smacking right into our orientation with all of its scheming, distractions, containment of our wisdom through self-criticism. Either way, we are encountering reality ourselves. It is splendid and unparalleled, simple and always available to us. So easy for us to conclude, I had a good Zazen session, or one not so great. You may have found yourself doing that a few times today. Oh, that was a good one, or that was a bad one, or the whole day was one or the other. What is the basis of that assessment? When we say it was a good session, likely it means we felt like we were accomplishing something important. Relevant, in other words, according with our orientation. As I said earlier, the more we act on our orientation, the more we strengthen it, reinforcing the bonds between synapses in our brain so it has more and more staying power, even in the face of contrary evidence. It leads us to not paying attention to what's happening, to ignoring the reactions on our friend's face, sabotaging our intentions to be patient and more kind, and extinguishing any contrary possibilities for living. In this way of looking at it, a tremendously boring period of Zazen is a huge blessing. A session in which I noticed that all my attention was on planning my week. I know more than one person who does that. So a session in which I noticed that I was planning my week, no matter how many times I turned away from it, that could reveal my usual hidden orientation, that success follows anticipation. And that can also be a gigantic gift. In the spirit of Dogen, here is an orientation for sitting. Free from my orientation. How wonderful. We get those now and then. Maybe every one of your sittings is like that. Stuck in my orientation and feeling constrained. How illuminating. Norman's not here except in my talk, except in all of our hearts too, but I bring him up a lot today. Norman also keeps writing to direct us to practice and show us what happens when we live from there. Am I the only one who thinks Norman's in competition with Dogen to see who can do the most writing? He keeps saying, that's my last book. That's my last Dharma book. He keeps saying, I had a few days off and wrote a 100-page poetry book. Norman. He keeps writing to direct us to practice and show us what happens when we live from there unmoored from our orientation. In this book, precisely the point being made, from 1993, he wrote, "And it is out of our great misery that we write. Sometimes we forget that Norman is writing about himself all the time. And it is out of this great misery that we write, out of a sense that nothing else will work. We choose the means and the terms. We mind the depths and curl the ends of our tongue. It is like this, a feeling inside that breaks up into words that do not convey thought. Thought is paramount, six or seven organized ideas at least, and we created a dialogue, a theory that explains our simple mistrust of a way of thinking that destroys. We threw out the whole thing and started over. Afterwards, we explained it. What do I mean? Do I know whereof I speak? What did I say? Do I know what I said? Where did I go? Did I go to any place? Two of them will take me. One of them will take me here and over there in pieces, by the square around it, and in the fact that it means there must be an elsewhere, we can feel the depth of it. I always say, no such thing as the present. Only the part, only the past, only the future squeezing one out of shape. Our little lives, like a finger snap, don't amount to much. Just an arrangement of the same stuff that's always been here. Moving in and out of the various combinations like clouds transformed in the sky. Our hearts alive like a sun disk in the back near the spine. Nothing to ache for, nothing to want. All the ones are ones, the twos are twos. They don't know how precisely it's so, so they can't settle down that it's precisely so. That is so, though. Birds sing differently on different days according to their codes or scripts. You know your dog. As we listen to that or not, fall into it or get distracted by her habitual minds, we are in the gravitational pull of our orientation or rocketed out of it. Either way, we are shown what is the case in this moment. Over time, as our gripping of our fundamental survival views lessens, we can engage with studying, reading, chanting, and ceremonies and let them show us what they are instead of us making them into what we need them to be. Here are some of the ways that Dogen expresses that in his poetry. Treading along in this dreamlike illusory realm, without looking for the traces I may have left, a cuckoo song beckons me to return home. Hearing this, I tilt my head to see. Who has told me to turn back? But do not ask me where I am going. As I travel in this limitless world, where every step I take is my home. Treading along in this dreamlike, illusionary realm, without looking for the traces I may have left. A cuckoo song beckons me to return home. Hearing this, I tilt my head to see who has told me to turn back. But do not ask me where I am going as I travel in this timeless world where every step I take is my home. And the original mind ground is at rest, naturally at one with the spiritual, without ever having to strive for the Dharma, experiencing the truth in this body, forgetting about labels like sacred and profane. The world-honored one Buddha was enlightened on seeing the bright morning star while looking up with a weary but enraptured face. The original mind ground is at rest, naturally at one with the spiritual, without ever having to strive for the Dharma, experiencing the truth in this body, forgetting about labels like sacred and profane. The world-honored one, Buddha, was enlightened on seeing the bright morning star while looking up with a weary but enraptured face. We get released from the cage of our relevant restrictions by not insisting on them in all the ways we do. Trying to get more out of something or get rid of it. Attempting to know how we are doing by comparison to others. Letting go, a common injunction in psychotherapy and Zen instructions, is an active continuous loosening of our insistence that everything we experience be relevant for us, for our ongoing project of protecting, entertaining, promoting, legitimizing ourselves. Gratitude originates here and takes root. The ancient Zen question, what is this, can be an alternative to our intractable orientation of making something into what's good for us or unwanted by us. Most of Zen, for many of us, doesn't make much sense until we catch on that it is trying to not make sense in the usual way so that it can teach us about how we are orienting ourselves, how we are walling ourselves away from reality by our tyrannical project that everything must make sense to me and on my terms. What happens when we embrace life in all of its dimensions, not because it is good for me, but simply good? This is where I cue the Talking Heads. They made a whole album called stop making sense, letting the days go by, water flowing underground, same as it ever was, same as it ever was. Time is not after us. Time is not holding us. We can stop making the same kind of sense that we always have, the kind of sense the past brings us. Maybe you noticed this week, those of you who read the news, maybe you noticed an obituary for Monty Roberts this week. He had a long life and died at 91. He was raised in a family that trained horses, broke horses in the parlance of that tradition. But he saw something different in horses. When he asked his father if they could train their horses with more patience and kindness, his father beat him without mercy, with a chain so that he required medical attention. But Monty had been freed from the traditional orientation. He went to the high desert and observed horses communicating through eye contact and body nudges. He took this into his work with horses and built relationships and cooperation. He influenced untold numbers of horse trainers, writing a book that sold 6 million copies and becoming friends with Queen Elizabeth, also an avid lover of horses. Our orientation can fall away, even when it's charged with family survival strategy. No waiting required. No schedule when it's supposed to happen. This central task only you can do. It releases all of your focus, creativity, love, and wonder into what is yours to live. Numberless people. Numberless people are in it with you, letting your orientation turn into vapor and drift away. Thank you. That was my talk. So, thank you. We're going to do exercises in threes, which some of you is the favorite part. For some of you, wish we never did this. But here we go. For those of you who are new to us, this might be surprising to you. In the day where we've asked you to be quiet all day, we're going to ask you to now talk. In a moment, you'll be self-organized into groups of three. You can move your chairs around into groups of three. And that will also be done for the people online. And it's a chance for you to share your experience of the Dharma. It's not a chance to try and convince anybody or impress anybody, but just to share from your own experience, from your own heart, from your own life. To keep it safe, we ask that you keep it confidential. You don't share with anybody else what happens in your group, and don't interrupt anybody else when they speak. The way we'll do this is in the groups of three, each person will have 3 minutes to speak, and then we'll rotate around. And we have a prompt. So I came up with something that could start the conversation. So feel free to take that up as you wish. And if it doesn't suit you and if something else is more real, more important, more in the center for you, speak from there. All right, so here's the prompt. What's your best sense of your current life orientation? What's your best sense of your current life orientation? Here's another angle on it. How do you gauge what's relevant for you? How do you gauge what's relevant for you? Okay, can you please put yourself into a group of three?